We aren't reviewing our regulations because we feel that they're inadequate. We're reviewing them primarily to ensure that we're up with current technology and operating practices.
The state considers new rules for oil and gas fracking. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, who should pay for school physicals? Not parents, according to one school board in the state.
I dragged my heels because I kept waiting to hear what was going to happen on this, but now I got to fork over $120+.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is reviewing a set of regulations aimed at alleviating public concerns about hydraulic fracturing or fracking in the state. APRN's Ann Hillman attended a hearing on the issue today and has this story.
Hydraulic fracturing is also known as fracking. It's the process of pumping pressurized fluids into oil and gas wells. The fluids include fine particles, like sand, that prop open new cracks, allowing more petroleum products to be released. Companies have been fracking in Alaska for decades. One of the major concerns about the process is how the chemically enhanced fluids could affect groundwater. Commissioner Kathy Forrester says the AOGCC started looking at the fracking regulations last spring.
We aren't reviewing our regulations because we feel that they're inadequate. We're reviewing them primarily to ensure that we're up with current technology and operating practices. But the big thing we're doing for the public, to address the public concerns, is that we're creating a new section titled Hydraulic Fracturing.
Under the proposed regulations, companies would have to notify all landowners within a half a mile of the drilling wells of their activities. They would also have to test samples from water wells in the same area before fracking. Kara Moriarty of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association says that requirement will lead to higher costs for the companies.
And whenever there's increased cost, there could be ramifications on overall production and resource extraction. And so from our standpoint, that's a risk that could be associated with these proposals.
Moriarty is proposing the companies just sample 4 wells instead of all of them. She and other industry representatives also find fault with the requirements to let the public know all of the chemicals used in the fracking fluids. She says they're fine with disclosing most of them, but they don't want to give away any secrets.
If they can't get their recipe protected, as they continue to evolve and make their practices better, Alaska may miss out on the opportunity to have the latest and greatest recipe out there for enhanced recovery and environmental protection.
But Barrett Risteroff of the Wilderness Society says the new regulations don't go far enough, especially since Alaska may eventually be home to unconventional oil shale fracking. Though she supports the new water sampling rules and full chemical disclosure, she says the regulations also need to address flaring. That's the burning of gases like methane that are released during the drilling process.
But it's an issue here in Alaska. The regulations are very general about flaring. They just say something along the lines of we need to prevent waste. But it doesn't give any specifics about, say, we need to install this kind of technology on a well so that we won't be letting all this gas into the air.
The commission will review the comments submitted during the hearing, and within 30 days will either create the new regulations or ask for another round of comments on their revisions. For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
By 2015, every ship that operates on Alaska's southern coast will be required to drastically cut their sulfur emissions. The state has been fighting that policy in court, and this week a federal judge threw out their case. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
For years, the international community has been trying to lower the amount of sulfur that ships put into the atmosphere. It's nasty stuff that causes acid rain and damages human health. Here's Earth Justice Attorney Sarah Burt.
It causes all sorts of heart and lung diseases. It causes asthma. It's one of the most significant pollutants in poor air quality.
Back in 2009, the more than 150 countries that are part of the MARPOL Convention, short for marine pollution, agreed that Alaska's coast should be part of a large ocean zone where emissions are tightly regulated. Ships would have to start using expensive low-sulfur fuels, or they would have to invest in upgrading their exhaust systems. That did not sit well with the state, which held that the regulations weren't necessary because Alaska already has good air quality. The state also argued that the new rules could hurt Alaska's economy by lowering ship traffic and keeping cruise lines away. The U.S. District Court didn't buy it, and Judge Sharon Gleason dismissed the case. Sarah Burt, who intervened in the case on the side of the federal government, says it was a matter of protecting America's international credibility.
If a court then turned around and said, well, actually, no, for whatever reasons, we decide that we don't want to actually implement the treaty that we have signed, it sends mixed messages to the international community and could potentially be very embarrassing for the United States.
Department of Law attorneys were unavailable to speak to the case, but the governor's office says in a statement that they still believe Alaska was improperly included in the emissions control area. They may appeal the ruling. In the meantime, the cruise industry is already preparing for the new standards. Earlier this month, Carnival Cruise Lines announced its plans to outfit 32 of their ships with new air pollution scrubbers as a way of lowering their sulfur output. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The state has released draft fine particulate pollution regulations. They're designed to be part of an overdue implementation plan the DEC is required to submit to the Environmental Protection Agency, which designates Fairbanks as a non-attainment area due to wintertime emissions from wood and coal burning. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
A public notice lists seven regulation changes aimed at reducing smoke. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Division of Air Quality Director Alice Edwards says they allow for the state to ban wood burning when pollution is severe.
In the case of an episode, the department could, under these proposals, could require that people not burn.
Edwards says the ban would not be enforced on wood burners who do not have an alternative heat source.
We're trying to make that provision more flexible so that we can ensure that people who do need to continue to burn wood during those episodes can. We clearly are not going to do anything that would prevent somebody from having heat in their home.
Edwards emphasizes that a ban would only target localized areas when pollution is acute. Other proposed regulation changes include a restriction on wintertime open burning, a list of what types of fuels can be legally burned, and emission standards for wood and coal stoves and boilers manufactured, sold, or installed in the Fairbanks North Star Borough non-attainment area. The DEC will hold four open houses on the proposed regulations in the Fairbanks area. The first is scheduled for October 2nd. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
This past weekend, a large windstorm drove the fishing vessel Chaos aground just outside Unalaska. Rough weather delayed a Coast Guard air rescue of the boat's crew. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, it might keep salvagers away also.
The Chaos is a 54-foot longliner based out of Homer. Its four crew members were trying to make it back to town Friday night before a heavy storm struck. Coast Guard Petty Officer Sarah Moore says they didn't make it. The wind and rain started early, so the crew sought shelter in a small cove in Unalaska Bay.
They were at anchor, and the high winds actually broke their anchor and pushed them ashore. And so they contacted the harbor master, who then contacted us.
The Coast Guard sent an MH-65 Dolphin helicopter from a forward base in Cold Bay, along with an MH-60 Jayhawk from Kodiak. The pilots tried to pick up the Chaos crew right away, but Moore says the weather was too rough.
Due to the high winds, they weren't able to conduct any hoists to rescue the crew, but they were able to make contact with them and establish that they were reasonably safe. The vessel was intact and up on the rocks.
Moore says the Coast Guard asked the fishermen to stay put and wait for calmer weather. But around midnight, the winds were rocking the vessel so violently that they thought it might flip over. The fishermen tried to swim to shore and spend the night on land. Once they got there, they found that the beach was being pelted by rocks that were blowing off the cliffs overhead, so they swam back to the boat and waited. By Saturday morning, the weather had calmed down. Moore says an MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter flew back out to the bay.
The 60 conducted the hoists of the four mariners aboard and brought them to Dutch Harbor.
There were no reports of injuries among the crew members, but an emergency medical team met them at the airport to perform checkups. Now that the crew is safe, the Coast Guard's turning their attention to the stranded vessel. The Chaos is still on the rocks in Unalaska Bay. on Alaska's Coast Guard Marine Safety Detachment is monitoring it for signs of a spill. The vessel's only holding between 50 and 100 gallons of fuel, and so far none of that has leaked. Lieutenant Mark Labert says the owner and master of the Chaos have been working on a salvage plan, but it doesn't look like they'll be able to get the boat back before the next big storm hits on Alaska. The National Weather Service is forecasting winds of up to 85 miles per hour starting Tuesday afternoon. That's even stronger than the storm that sent the Chaos aground in the first place. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a stop in Alaska for a cyclist biking around the world.
I waved goodbye to my friends and my family from there, and I took off through Europe, through a very, very cold Europe. It's the coldest in 30 years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The Southeast Conference wants to change the way the Tongass National Forest is managed. The Regional Development Advocacy Organization is working on a strategy to grow the timber industry and create jobs while maintaining environmental protections. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from the Southeast Conference's annual meeting in Sitka.
Conference leaders say the U.S. Forest Service is failing to do its job. That, in the organization's view, is to sell enough timber to support a strong regional wood products industry.
We're trying to open up the landscape to a management strategy that is changing over time.
Shelley Wright is executive director of the Southeast Conference, made up of business, government, and tribal leaders, as well as interested individuals.
Rather than set aside a big chunk for logging and a big chunk for no logging, open up all of the regulated set-asides and use it as a flexible forest.
National monuments, designated wilderness, and some other protected areas would stay the same. Buffer zones would still be required near beaches, streams, and rivers. But Wright says many other parts of the Tongass would be open for multiple and sometimes changing uses.
A stand of trees doesn't have to be 150 years old to be habitat. Different habitat is good for different times of year, different kinds of animals. So we want them to manage it, actively manage and monitor all parts of the forest for habitat and economic development.
I think they're looking backwards to recreate the glory days of timber on the Tongass, which unfortunately are over.
Andrew Tomes is executive director of the Sitka Conservation Society, which has been part of the forest management debate.
The Tongass produced a record number of salmon this past year that created a ton of jobs and a ton of economic activity from the fisheries. I think that the Southeast Conference wants to ignore the fact that all these salmon come from the forest and that they're produced because of the protections that we have on the salmon streams.
And, by the way, he says the forest does take 150 years or longer to fully mature. The existing Tongass management plan has been developed over years of public debate. It's attracted attention from national environmental organizations and has been driven in part by policy calls from Washington, D.C. So what does the Forest Service think of the conference's strategy?
I believe that it's a legitimate proposal.
Tongass Forest Supervisor Forrest Cole hasn't seen the conference's formal proposal, though he's talked to its authors.
I believe over the life of the current forest plan, we've probably looked at 30 or 40 different alternatives, and I'm guessing that if we get into a modification of the plan in the near future, we'll look at a wide variety again. So having a recommendation from Southeast Conference for looking at alternatives is a welcome proposal for us.
The conference hired Canadian timber consultant Don Reimer to do the research to back up its approach. He says the strategy could increase timber jobs from under 500 to more than 2,000 over a number of years. He also says it would save taxpayers money.
We think that would basically be able to eliminate most of the cash drain that you have on the Tongass because you'd now have an active timber program like you used to have in the past that should pay for the restoration work and some of that stuff that needs to be done, instead of having a drain on the treasury.
Southeast Conference leaders acknowledge their approach could be a hard sell. That's why they hired Willis Lyford of Anchorage-based Percaro Communications to spread their message.
We need to change the debate and the discussion about the timber industry in Alaska. And that takes a lot of hard work and a lot of research and a lot of study and people who are experts.
The company recently polled Southeast and other Alaskans to gauge their views of the industry. He shared results indicating strong support for logging, including its expansion. But it also showed concerns about environmental damage and other impacts. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from the Southeast Conference's annual meeting in Sitka.
Should parents pay for a state-required physical exam for new students entering a public school in Alaska? That was the question raised by a member of Petersburg School Board this summer. KFSK's Joe Viknicki reports.
Alaska statute requires each school district to, quote, provide for and require a physical examination of every child attending school in the district, unquote. The law requires that exam, for the most part, to be performed by a physician when the child is entering school. An opinion from attorney Alan Clendaniel this month says while no court has ruled on the issue, he thinks that law means the district is responsible for the cost of that exam. However, Petersburg Superintendent Rob Thomason told the board that no schools in Alaska are shouldering that cost.
To make a long story short, there are 54 school districts in the state of Alaska. 53 of them have kindergarten. One of them does not, Mount Edgecombe. Of the 53 who do have kindergarten, not one district pays for the required health physical of a kindergartner. It is the attorney's opinion, based on the current language of the law, that school districts should be paying for those.
The attorney's opinion noted that the language has been in statute prior to statehood, and that the original 1953 territorial law even provided funding of $2.50 per pupil to help pay for exams. That's a long way from the cost of a checkup these days, and it was an issue for board member Sarah Holmgren. She said she'd recently took her kid in for a physical, but was reluctant to pay.
I dragged my heels because I kept waiting to hear what was going to happen on this, but now I got to fork over $120+ to pay for this. And they didn't do anything that the school district doesn't do already. It's a waste of money for both the parent as well as the school district.
Holmgren was referring to health screening already performed by the nurse at the local elementary school. She did not want to require a separate physician's exam if it was not necessary.
Do we have any new students or incoming kindergartners that have not done it yet? And what do we do now?
Yeah.
And I would be inclined to say, I don't think we have a leg to stand on to make them require it. Mm-hmm. Unless we turn around and reimburse them. And it's whether we want to go through that.
Board member Don Ware was worried about setting a precedent if the district did cover the costs for anyone not getting an exam for their kid. And board member Cheryl File thought of another solution.
Cheryl? It would be nice if our nurse could do it.
Yeah.
If they could change it to where the school nurse could do it. Mm-hmm. That would be...
That'd be the easy answer.
Mm-hmm.
For school districts that have nurses. Now you have...
Right.
Some that don't. So they actually need a variety of options to get this requirement met. It might be a school nurse. It might be a community health nurse. It mm-hmm. might be a village clinic.
Mm-hmm.
That's Superintendent Thomason responding. He asked for direction from the board whether Petersburg schools should take on that cost or seek a change in state law. Some districts in the state do rely on a nurse to provide exams as a temporary measure if no physician is immediately available or if a parent is not compliant. That's according to Mary Bell, a school health nurse consultant in the state's Division of Public Health.
I actually hear from school districts quite a bit about this statute. It definitely has some challenges. There were not regulations that were written. It's an older statute. It's been on the books for a while. And so we're aware of the challenges, we're looking at clarifying some of them.
Petersburg's board ultimately directed the superintendent to tackle the issue on three fronts. Those are coming up with a solution for any current students who have not complied with the exam requirement, seeking a possible change in state law during the upcoming legislative session, and putting forth a resolution before the Alaska Association of School Boards. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Viknicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th.
This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
The dual management structure that exists in Alaska to govern subsistence hunting and fishing was among the issues raised last week during a committee hearing in the U.S. Senate. KDLG's Mike Mason listened in and has the story.
The Energy and Natural Resources Committee in the U.S. Senate held a hearing Thursday focused on the impacts of landmark federal legislation on subsistence activities in the state of Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski is the ranking Republican on the committee, which has jurisdiction over the Alaska National Interest Lands Act and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
To my knowledge, a hearing of this nature has never occurred in this committee, even though this is the committee of jurisdiction.
Senator Murkowski labeled Thursday's hearing in Washington as a follow-up to the two public meetings she sponsored earlier this year in the state of Alaska. Murkowski admitted that Thursday's hearing would not solve all of the issues surrounding subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska, but she hoped it would start an ongoing dialogue among stakeholders that could eventually result in acceptable solutions. Among those invited to testify Thursday was Gene Peltola. He's the new Assistant Regional Director for the Office of Subsistence Management within the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Peltola came to the job after serving as the manager of the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge.
Subsistence management in Alaska is not an exact science. It's not perfect, and it is very complex. We must balance the differing mandates and policies of the parties involved, yet remain true to our charge of providing for the continued subsistence use by local rural residents.
The only person representing the state of Alaska to testify during Thursday's hearing was Craig Fleener. He's a deputy commissioner with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Fleener outlined many of the challenges facing Alaska's subsistence users.
The federal subsistence framework in Alaska has been a source of great consternation amongst federally qualified subsistence users since its inception. They've pleaded for active management on federal lands and for federal land managers to work with the state to improve important populations like moose, caribou, and deer. Perhaps the greatest complication for a subsistence community is dual regulation of fish and game resources. Conflicting regulations, divergent agency mandates, and different management strategies create confusion for the hunting and fishing community in Alaska.
Some of the most moving testimony given Thursday came from Anna Hoffman. She's the president and CEO of the Bethel Native Corporation. She suggests that the continued access to subsistence hunting and fishing is the reason that most of the villages in the YK Delta region still exist.
If you walk into any classroom in rural Alaska and ask the students what they ate for dinner, they will likely answer soup. But it is not French onion or vegetable beef. It is fish soup, moose soup, caribou soup, seal soup, swan soup, walrus soup, goose soup, beaver soup, and crane soup, all accompanied with dry fish. This is our sustenance.
Thursday's hearing only included formal testimony from those invited to speak and some questions from the members of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. However, a working group was scheduled to convene Thursday afternoon to delve deeper into the issues raised during the formal hearing. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Dr. Steve Fabes from London is in the midst of a six-continent bicycle ride. While cycling the length of North America, Fabes took time off to fly to Juneau and Anchorage last week to talk about his epic trip. KTOO's Lisa Fu caught up with Fabes and has this story.
Dr. Steve Fabes' bicycle journey started January 2010 when he left his job as an internist in a London hospital.
I waved goodbye to my friends and my family from there, and I took off through Europe, through a very, very cold Europe. It was the coldest in 30 years.
But the seed for the trip was planted long before. When Fabes was 19, he cycled through Chile with his younger brother. That trip got him thinking of a bigger bike ride, one around the world. After completing medical school and starting his career as a doctor, the desire for more adventure nagged at him.
Eventually it came to a head and I thought, I need to make a decision, and I decided I have to go for it. I don't want to get old with any regrets. This has to happen.
After crossing Europe, Fabes traveled into the Middle East and then cycled down the east coast of Africa. The goal of Fabes' journey is to cycle through six continents. So far, he's completed four. But the trip has another purpose as well.
On the way, I stop and visit remote medical clinics to gain a bit of understanding about how the neglected tropical diseases are targeted on the front line.
In the realm of tropical diseases, people often think about HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. In his travels, Fabes is highlighting the 17 infectious diseases that are neglected.
They're medically diverse, they're mainly parasitic infections, and they're a huge burden. 1 billion people worldwide affected, so that's 1/6 of the Earth's population.
When Fabes is not visiting mobile medical clinics, he's stopping around the world to give talks on what he's learned and to shed light on the issue. Fabes is also living a simpler, less complicated life on a bike.
You have to narrow things down and you have to take exactly what you need because every gram counts. And when you're cycling up a mountain, you know, your mind's going to be thinking about all those things you don't necessarily need.
Aside from items to camp and cook with and a few pieces of clothing, Fabes also carries a few luxury items, a laptop, which he bought once he crossed the border into the United States, some books, and an iPod. Fabes has spent most nights either camping or in cheap hostels, among other places.
I've slept in schools, police stations, churches, mosques, monasteries, army barracks. I've slept in a shed with a water buffalo. I've slept in all kinds of places.
As for showering, Fabe says he isn't doing it as much as he should.
My record is 11 days without a shower. When I've been cycling through Alaska, I could just jump in rivers and stuff, and it's really cold. But if that's my only option, then that's what you just have to do.
On his journey so far, Fabe says he's grown to trust people.
99.9% of people have been very kind, hospitable, generous. And that's been the recurring theme of my trip, really. The defining feature is just the generosity of people I've met along the way.
Fabe still has another 2 continents, more than 2 years, and about 30 countries left in his bike ride. Next month, he flies to Australia, where he'll cycle up the east coast of the country, onto Indonesia, then the rest of Asia, and back across Europe to home. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Ann Hillman from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.